Were you able to take certain things with you?
What good does it do? Okay, we took certain things. We put on another suit on top of you, another suit on top of you. You can only wear one pair of shoes. Okay. So you had what they call a rucksack. A rucksack, you know, is a... what would it be in English?
Shoulder bag.
Yeah. A rucksack. So if...
Backpack.
Backpack. Okay. But that backpack, if the SS had a bad eye on you, he just took a knife and cut the strap, you know, and just dropped it. Off. Yeah, okay. That's how we went on the train.
All right, but you all went together.
Well, we were separated. We were separated. We went together, of course. The only thing I can still remember that my sister and my father, we ran into each other somehow. My dad said, this is the end. So we came to Auschwitz, was at night. And of course you select to the right, to the left, you know, to the right, to the left. I was sent to the right. We thought that this is already, you know, into the gas chamber because they packed us in into a bathroom, well, with the shower heads, you know, a public bath, the shower heads. So we thought that this is it, you know, gas is going to come out of the same thing. Then about an hour, 2 hours later, and they said, somebody informed us that, relax, tomorrow morning you're going to be processed for work. In other words, you're going to get new clothing, you're going to be showered, you know, haircut, shaved, and what have you. And next day the process began. Snow about 2 or 3 feet deep. The only thing you the left arm is a leather belt and a pair of boots or the shoes, whatever you had on. So you stood in line in the snow until you got into the bath, the shower, and you came out from the other side with a striped suit. So next day, next morning, while entering the line, it went alphabetically, you know, according to the ABC. So my brother came behind me the next day. So he has, I have 47, he has 48.
Mr. Comas was just showing me the number on his arm. What is the number there?
It's 77347. And he had 348 behind me. All right. So we were in Auschwitz for one night. Next day, different arm treatment. What's the matter now? They selected strong men for another camp. See, Auschwitz was the main, and the surrounding had all kinds of camps. Every 10 kilometers was a different camp. Strong men for a camp that does the coal mining. So at this point I was separated from my brother. I was the strong one. That's it. I was a coal miner from 1942 till 1944. Around October 44, I believe, either September or October, when the bombardments came a little bit more frequent, you know, and they damaged another camp site. They damaged the roofs, the gutters, you know, and all that, the other machinery. They had a big plant. That's for the IG Farben industry. Maybe you heard of them, I don't know. The IG Farben industry, they called it. And they produced from the coal, they made all kinds of fuel. Grease, fuel, medicine, what have you, out of the coal. So I was transferred out of the coal mine as a skilled worker. So I was transferred out of the coal mine into that camp. That was for the first time that I saw daylight. I worked 21 hours a day in the coal mine. 3 hours of sleep.
For how long?
42 to 44.
You worked 21 hours a day? Every day?
We left 3 o'clock in the morning. It was off day. We came back into the camp. It was 12 o'clock at night. It's unbelievable. That other camp, and I came to that other camp already, which was all kinds of people. So I found a few for my runcemen, you know, from home. And they were already old ones. They knew, you know, the ropes around there, and they gave me help, a little bit extra food, this and that. Plus, now this is something to take note of, that anybody saw the number, they knew when I came, where I have been. That gave him respect, because they saw few left with this number. So that didn't let me do any heavy work. In the other camp that I came in, they made me foreman of a group to supervise them with the work, you know, like the roofing and all that. And then we got already to a little bit easier. First of all, you could breathe fresh air. That's for one thing. Then those people who were on the same commando or on the same camp said, "You have respect for him. He's a Sieben Siebitziger. He's a 77, number 77.
What was it about the number 77?
That means... That's the year when he came. He came in 1942, and he survived, because there's only 3 or 4 left. Like in that one camp that I was in, survived that I know of, It's three, four people. And the first in the coal mine. Four people. In the other camp, only one survived. From this number. We knew by the number where the people are from. Or he is Italian, or he is Hungarian, or he is German, where he came from. There was no name at that time. It didn't call by name. Only 77,000, period. It's funny, as a youngster, I had a boyfriend. We went to Haida together. Before the war, his family left for Belgium. And he was a youngster, only 8, 9 years old. Left for Belgium. So forget about it. We were in camp in Auschwitz on the coal mine there. So every evening you had to be what they call an appel, the counting. You know, you have to see, you know, if the same amount of people came back as they went out. Somehow the SS commander calls a name, Brooke. Brooke. I said, the name is so familiar, Brooke, Belgium. And we were in the same block. You know the block is a barrack. In the same barrack. He slept on one side of, in other words, three, what do they call it? I can't think of the name right now. Not beds, you know, the three
bunks.
Bunks. So he had on one side, you know, there was an aisle in the middle, he on one side, and I on the other side. And he was in the same barrack, and I didn't even know who he is until they called out his name. And he left there, he was maybe 8 or 9 years old. Here we got together in camp. All right, so another friend that left for France. Family left for France, and they were kids. Found them in Auschwitz. So it's the only thing I can say. I believe this Thursday is Shavuos. And Shavuos, if you will notice, they read Akadomis, I believe they call it. That there's nothing to do with the Torah, there's something else, you know, that's besides that. And those passage, the glory, you know, that when the Jews received the Torah, you know, from the Har Sinai, you know, Sinai, and they sang, you know, and danced. And so one passage says, if all the skies would have been parchment, and all the oceans would be ink, wouldn't be enough room to describe the glory of God. Okay? This is the same thing. I don't care how many books people have written and how many they're going to write. It's not enough. nobody is able of describing what went on, because there's not enough paper, not enough ink to take in every detail what happened in 6 years. The Holocaust, Dr. Weiss. It's true, every detail, but it's only a fraction of 1%, not even that. Take one Dr. Weiss, multiply it by 6 million. The same damn story. Everybody went through more, less, you know, a little different, you know, here and there, but basically they're all the same. This is true. That's the ghetto. That's how it was. That's how people lived.
You ever know what happened to the rest of your family? Your mother and your dad?
They're not here, so I know what happened.
You said that when you first came to Auschwitz, you went into a shower room.
Yeah.
You thought it might be the gas chamber.
Yeah.
Did you know about the gas chambers before?
We heard about it, yes.
How is it that you heard?
Somehow, I don't know how, but apparently that from every, we knew about the liquidation of Jews before that, in 1941, that is a direct liquidation, that people were taken out from the Warsaw Ghetto on automobiles. Guessed. How did it happen? How did we find out? Somehow somebody survived that gas, came back.
Did people believe them when these stories came back?
No. Because I said, how is it possible to take a direct human being and kill him, innocent. A man, a child, a boy, a girl. Direct, put him in an automobile and turn the gas on and gas him. Nobody believed it. That was the whole thing. There was always somebody that survived, even when they were shooting him, you know, they told him to dig a grave and line up, they're shooting him. Somebody survived there from the grave and got out. He got mingled up, you know, among the dead, and he survived, came back and told the story.
And nobody believed him.
Nobody believed him. That's true. Nobody believed him. I will say it myself. I didn't believe it.
What did they think he was saying this for?
They didn't have nothing specific or detailed, you know, saying. The only thing they knew is they survived. Period. Run for your life. Where are you going to run? There was no place where to run. We're just killing like sitting ducks, shooting. No place where to run.
So how long were you in the camps?
From 1942 to 45. Then we transferred from Buchenwald, from Auschwitz to Buchenwald. Because the Russians were behind us. So it was January. January 18, I believe, was it? Yes. It was January 18, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We start marching from one camp. The Russians were behind us, maybe a mile or 2 miles, you know, away. They burned, all day long they were burning the papers, documents, and all that. So, and I don't know, God got mad at us. And the heaviest blizzard of the year came down that night. We marched from 5 o'clock in the afternoon till about 10 o'clock next night. We finally came into a camp, Gliwice. It was Gliwice 1 and Gliwice 2. We came into Gliwice. Hunger. We fell down dead, tired. As a matter of fact, whenever I think about it, I said, how dumb can a human being be? The snow about 3 feet deep. You lay down in the snow, but you cover yourself up. So you shouldn't freeze, but you lay on the snow. So we were there overnight. And they gave each a half a loaf of bread. Piece of salami or whatever it was, meat, I believe, a piece of salami, and shipped us on the train from Gliwice to Buchenwald. 10 days on an open boxcar. Snow, snowing over your head, and no place where to sit down because we were packed.
No roof on this?
No, but open box cars. Finally, about 5 days later or so, a little bit more room became available because people died. They took them out. Put them on another open car, all dead, all piled up. So we had a little bit more room to sit down. All right. But in a way, I'll say that we were lucky. It was snowing, heavy snow. So we ate snow from somebody else's shoulder. Until we finally got to Buchenwald. Buchenwald, and they started shipping us around all over the places. You know, they had camps all over Germany. And I said to my friends that we were together, you know, in the previous camp. Like I said, I had a command of, I believe, four or five, two Hungarians, two Polish boys. And those two Polish boys were hanging out to me. We became friends. They were hanging out to me, and we became into Buchenwald. I said to them, we don't leave from here. Here we're going to stay. We don't go to any other camp. Are you with me? Say, yep. Because the bombardments over Germany was quite heavy already. Buchenwald is on a hill. You could look down there on Erfurt. You could see the bombardments, the planes, you know. I say it's only 30 miles from down there. So every day they were shipping, we were 60,000 in that camp when we came in. 10 days later, they were shipping out 6,000 people a day. You know, it's just like if the cow doesn't want to go into the slaughterhouse, you take a little hay and you, you know, tease him into the slaughterhouse. Same thing was over there. If you go, they will give you a half a loaf of bread or whatever it was there to be. I don't know exact what how much bread they gave you. And if a person is hungry, he will go, even if he knows behind that gate, you know, might be death, but he'll go because he's hungry. And I said to those two youngsters, we're not going from here to what we have set up. Every 2 hours, somebody's gonna keep post so that the others can sleep and see if any activities goes on, just notify us so we can move out from that area, go somewhere else. We saved ourselves. So one day we got caught in the jam. They blocked off this area and we are in it. I said to the two boys, come with me. We went into the Scheiß room, the shit house. You know. Shit houses was a ditch with a post on top, and that was running, you know, from one camp to the other. Come with me, we went down there to that and up to the other camp. We saved us, saved ourselves this way. And that was dragged down to about April. April 10th. It was already taking out only 10,000, I believe, left, or 12,000 people left. Of course, there was all kinds of nationalities there. There were Ukrainians and Russians and Germans and all that. So they decided to put all the Jews into one barrack. It was a three-floor barrack. Three-story barrack with the intention to blow it up with us in it. We didn't know, we found out 5 minutes later. As we went into that camp, apparently that the Russians knew about it, the Germans knew about it, and they organized themselves outside. Somehow they got in touch with the outside. And we heard It's over the loudspeaker. That everybody should go into safety because there's a Flieger alarm. It means an air raid. After that air raid, took about 5 minutes. American tanks came in. And those Russians and those Germans had weapons with them. And they took the SS that they were sending around the... They dropped their weapon. And we were saved at this moment. That was April 11, 1945.
Describe, before we get into what happened after liberation, describe generally the conditions of the camps you were in, the sanitary conditions, the food.
After the liberation?
Before the liberation.
The sanitary conditions in the places that I was, not Auschwitz, outside Auschwitz, cannot complain about sanitary conditions until we got to Buchenwald. Buchenwald was a different story. But in the camp, Jawischewicz, in the coal mine camp there, that I was there, sanitary conditions were good, I may say so. Because as soon as you got back from work, you had to go and take a shower. You got soap, you got a towel, and you had to change from work clothes, you know, to camp clothes. So sanitary was good. I cannot say there wasn't. Also, they had medical facilities, whatever the facility was available to them. Bandages was toilet paper. That was the bandages. But in general, as cleanliness, clean, this was the only camp that I've been in that you could say, you know, it's clean. It's clean, of course, we had to do it ourselves. Because we never had a free day or a free hour or after meal, or you came from work, you had to go take a shower, and after you took the shower, you had to run in and get your dish of soup, whatever it was there, a piece of bread and a piece of butter. We had we were considered as hard workers, so we had double ration. Instead of a third, we had a half loaf of bread, you know, per day. Well, that's what you got in the morning. And a dish of coffee, which was artificial coffee made, you know, ersatz coffee, in the morning, and a piece of bread, and this is what you went to work. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. Then you came back, it was 12 o'clock at night. So sanitary conditions, I wouldn't say that I didn't have nothing to complain about. And if you would only have the time to clean yourself, wash yourself, you know, and soap yourself, everything was in a hurry, rush, because there wasn't enough time. And you came back 11:30 or 11 o'clock. Well, you wanted to get to bed as soon as you can. Rest up a little bit, especially me. I had an accident in the coal mine. and I had a damaged leg and swell up.
What kind of accident?
In the coal mines, always accidents. Two trains got together and I was between it. Those are the little trains, you know, that carry coals, you know, there's not the big box cars.
Did you get some kind of medical attention?
Yes, yes, but you couldn't have too much medical attention, because if it takes up too much time, there's no freeloaders there. You can't work. We used to call it, you go on the frying pan. If you can't work. But there was one doctor, a Hungarian there, that he took care of the surgery without anesthetic. And one night I came back to the camp and I said, "Doctor, I just cannot make it. I cannot walk." This was 2 kilometers to work, to walk from camp to work, plus maybe another 2 or 3 kilometers underground, you know, to go to your place where you have to work. And I said, "I don't care if they send me to the frying pan or not. This is it." So what he did, that he took me in for 2 days, let me rest up, and sent me back to work for a day or two. Took me in another 2 days, sent me back to work. Like I said, I had muscle. Nothing else. No knacken. There's no such a thing. Being smart, I'll smarter them. No. I had muscle. Plus, I was stronger, ambitious, and the will to live. It's beyond anybody's imagination. I don't think that the average person will read about it or listen to the tape or see on television can ever understand what hunger means, what the will to live, it's a extra strength that's beyond human imagination. Can you imagine that I could lift a ton of coal? You know, the little wagons, they call it lorry. A lorry used to be a ton of coal. To lift a ton of coal to put it back on the rails because it popped out, I cannot believe it myself.
You fell over, you lifted it up?
Yeah, when it derailed.
Right.
I had to put it back on the rail.
You lifted it up to put it back on
the rail? Well, with skill. You know, you don't lift the whole thing.
I understand.
You lift one end, you know, and the
right.
All right. A little guy like me that weighed only 110 pounds, 115 pounds. Now, this is something else. Hunger. Would you believe that you can feed yourself on dandelions? Whenever I kill the dandelions out there, I never forget this. I never forget that. After the war, I said to my friend, You know something? Let's go out there where we used to march by and see if the dandelions taste as good as they used to taste a month or 2 months ago. My God, no, they didn't. But at that time, the dandelions were just as sweet as a chocolate eclair, if you could only find it. My wish was, all these years, when I lived through that, I said, if I have to die, I want to die 1 hour after the war to know the outcome and be able to sit down and have a loaf of bread in front of me and say, I'm not hungry. I have that. Thank God.
What did you do after you were liberated?
I lived in Germany, in Stuttgart, for 4 years. Until I got... Well, in the camp, you know, displaced person camp in Stuttgart.
What were you doing while you were there?
I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't doing a darn thing. The first year took about a year. I was out of my mind. Depressed. Especially when somebody found a brother or some relative that they were united again. I was so depressed that wasn't even funny. But I got myself out of it. I stopped, lift up my head again. Start all over again. Start all over again. Make plans. Where will you go? What is going to be your future? Where you go from here? What do you do? You're not going to sit in the camp all your life. Wait for the ration. To go for the rationing in the morning, go to the mess halls, you know, for dinner, go back and read or listen to the radio, or go somewhere. One night I sat down and I knew there's an address in New York. United Service for New Americans. I sat down and I wrote it in Yiddish.